very careful. "Well?" Craig demanded, misreading her silence. "Does that frighten you?" She took a deep breath, then replied, "No, Your Worship, it doesn't frighten me, because Stona will save us from such a calamity. I think he represents a gift from God, a way out of the nuclear holocaust that might devour us." She saw immediately that she had made a mistake. Craig pointed a shaking finger at her.
"That nuclear holocaust could be God's final cleansing, the final trumpet from the Book of Revelations."
"The end of the world," Angelique whispered.
"Fire and brimstone! It's predicted!"
But... Angelique cast about for some words that would move Bishop Craig from his acceptance of the final holocaust. "But would God destroy his own creations? Just snuff out everyone?"
"He would be calling us to our eternal reward," Bishop Craig said.
Now Angelique felt real fear. Not of God's ending the world in fire and brimstone, but of the blind acceptance of men high in the new morality, such as Bishop Craig. "Are there similar men in the rest of the world?" she asked herself. "Are the Chinese just as blindly fatalistic? And the jihadists?" Chapter 7. True to her plans, Sister Angelique subtly convinced Archbishop Overmeyer to ask her to oversee his office for the few days he'd be in the hospital.
"My staff is loyal and trustworthy," the Archbishop said while munching on his breakfast whole grain muffin. "But you're much closer to this Stoner person than any of them."
"Stoner is the key to everything, isn't he, Your Eminence?" Angelique murmured, her voice and face showing proper humility. The Archbishop wiped his mouth daintily with a paper napkin from his breakfast tray.
"He wants me to march into the Oval Office and tell the President to stop the nuclear program."
"He'd be willing to go with you, I'm sure," said Angelique. "He'd stand at your side."
"Would he?"
"Of course. I'm certain of it."
But even as she said the words, Angelique pictured herself standing before the President of the United States, with Stoner at her side.
The Archbishop's staff obviously resented having a mere nun come into their office. Not just joining the staff, but coming in as the Archbishop's personal executive assistant, representing the Archbishop himself, standing over them all. Angelique sensed their unspoken bitterness as they stood gathered in the Archbishop's office. 14 aides and department chiefs, 11 men and 3 women, all in black clerical garb, each of them sworn to loyalty to the Archbishop's wishes, each of them staring sullenly at this stranger who had suddenly walked in and taken charge. Their ages ranged from gray-haired to fuzzy-cheeked. Their attitudes were all hostile, even though they were trying to conceal it.
"This is only for a few days," Angelique assured them.
She had chosen wisely, she thought, not to stand behind the Archbishop's desk. Instead, she stood against one of the blank-screened walls, almost as if she were facing a firing squad. As sweetly as she could, Angelique told them,
"As you know, the Archbishop must remain in hospital for a few days. Nothing serious or life-threatening, but his enormous duties have taken their toll on his metabolism."
She saw a few sly grins among the staffers facing her. They knew about the Archbishop's obesity problem better than she did.
"No one outside these walls must know that the Archbishop is not here. Everything must proceed as usual."
"The Archbishop has a full schedule of appointments," said one of the younger men.
"You'll have to switch them from personal to electronic," Angelique replied. "You have a simulacrum program for the Archbishop, don't you?"
"Yes, but the program needs a human overseer to fill in direct responses when they're needed."
Angelique thought swiftly.
"Which of you handles the Archbishop's public relations?"
One of the gray-haired men slowly put his hand up.
"Can you speak for the Archbishop, then?"
"Me?"
He looked startled at the thought.
"Yes. Just speak in generalities," Angelique said.
With a smile, she added,
"You know, like a politician during an election campaign."
The others laughed softly.
"Can you do that?"
Angelique asked the PR man. Uncertainly, he answered,
"I guess so, if it's just for a few days."
"Good."
By the end of the day, Angelique had the office running smoothly enough.
The staff seemed cooperative, if not friendly, efficient, if not enthusiastic. It was only after they had all gone home for the day that Angelique allowed herself to sit at the Archbishop's desk. She called Raúl Tavalera and invited him to her apartment for dinner. Tavalera had spent the day cooped up in his own apartment. For more than an hour he had spoken with Holly Lane at the Goddard Habitat, but the rest of the time he'd devoted to studying history and cosmology on the TV nets. It was all history, he thought. The history of the human race and the history of the universe. Big and little, stars and people. There actually was a man who was born into an obscure nomadic tribe on the Gobi Desert who conquered most of the friggin' world, Tavalera learned. There actually is a gigantic black hole at the heart of the Milky Way galaxy that's gobbling up whole stars by the thousands and spewing out deadly radiation. Learning was fun, he realized. Too bad they don't make it fun in school. Through the whole long day, he waited for a call from Stoner. Nothing. The Starman didn't contact him, not even a hi, how are you, in his mind. I wonder where he is, Tavalera asked himself. Chapter 8 Stoner was back in New Tehran, in the mildly disordered office of the Iranian astronomer Karim Bakhtiar. This time, Bakhtiar sat beside Stoner on one of the wobbly plastic chairs, while his brother Ahmed sat behind the scientist's desk, wearing the tan uniform of a general in the Revolutionary Guard. It was easy to see that the two men were brothers. Ahmed Bakhtiar was slim and wiry like the astronomer, his skin the same tobacco leaf color. The general's thin face bore a thick dark mustache, and his hairline was receding. Otherwise, they might have been twins, almost.
My brother tells me you have traveled to the stars, said Ahmed Bakhtiar.
His voice was rough, rasping, as if his throat were inflamed. That's true, Stoner replied. The general smiled through his luxuriant mustache.
It is true that he told me this, or it is true that you have been to the stars.
Stoner grinned back at him. Both.
I see. And where is your starship?
In a high orbit.
General Bakhtiar's dark brows rose. There is no such spacecraft. Our radar
can't see it, Stoner said. But it's there, I assure you, as certainly as I'm here.
Which brings up the question of why you are here.
To convince you to stop your nuclear weapons program, Stoner said calmly. The general flicked a scowling glance at his brother. Karim Bakhtiar shrugged elaborately and said,
I didn't tell him. He already knew.
In a slightly stronger tone, Stoner said, General, you more than almost anyone else understands the devastation that nuclear war can bring.
The Israelis destroyed Tehran.
And you wiped out Israel. Has that made the world any better?
All you accomplished was to obliterate the excuse you gave your people for your government's failures. They attacked us first, General Bakhtiar insisted, his face reddening.
Stoner sighed. First, last, the result is the same. Millions killed. And what did you accomplish?
I wasn't in command at that time.
I know. You were only following orders. The astronomer said,
What's done is done. It can't be changed.
Very true, said Stoner. Turning back to the general, But now you are building nuclear weapons again, and missiles that can carry them across the world.
We've got to protect ourselves against the Americans.
And they want to protect themselves against you.
And the Chinese, added Karim Bakhtiar.
His bearded face turning sterner, Stoner asked, And what happens if one of your nuclear bombs falls into the hands of a terrorist group? General Bakhtiar almost smiled.
God knows.
You've been very clever all these years. You and other Islamic governments have funded terrorists, provided them arms, trained them.
The government of Greater Iran does not sponsor terrorism, the general said flatly.
Of course not, replied Stoner. Still, terrorist cells somehow find money and weapons and training. They still kill innocent people all around the world. Leaning forward slightly in the desk chair, General Bakhtiar said in a low, grating voice,